The Fletus Show is recorded in front of a live audience. On today's Bill of the Fletus Show, episodes 258, Glee, Pilgrims, Daffodils, and the Moon. All of this and more. The Fletus Show, starring Kenty and Melly the Cockatiel. Welcome to the Fletus Show. A low-calorie carbonated beverage for my joy. Hi, kids. I'm your host, Kenty. And with me in the studio is Melly the Cockatiel. We welcome you to another wonderful week. It is the weekend before Thanksgiving, a couple days before Thanksgiving by the time this comes up. How are you kids doing? I'm doing good. I have just finished performances of Two Gentlemen of Verona, so I was very busy. This past week, I had four performances, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it went off well, without a hitch. No problems. It was quite good. I got some good reviews when I left. Some audience members, you know, congratulated me. I had a supporting role. it was fun. I really enjoyed it. I haven't been on the stage since high school, and I really had a lot of fun doing it. But, you know, it was hard work. It was work that was enjoyable to do and, you know, fun and trying all at once. And it's the kind of work that you do, I mean, it's when you're doing acting, is really, it's the kind of job where you just really have to focus on yourself. You have to, and I don't mean that in a way, I don't mean that to be selfish. I mean, is that regardless of what is going on, right, you have to be focused on your character, on your lines, your focus on who's talking to you. I mean, of course, the other actors, the other characters, because you're part of a process of storytelling. And so you need to just focus on these things, your lines, your character, and react as things happen, you know. There are, what I have discovered, it was during the rehearsal period, I had, I usually, you know, look at my lines, and I really practice them still. I mean, I know them, but what I do is I practice the delivery in the back, and I follow the play through the text as it's going on, so I know when I'm coming in, and give me a sense of continuity about what, you know, I'm doing and in the scene. And so this one time, it was the second night, we were rehearsing the full thing, and I was like, you know, why is everybody else is in the back, like, reading a book and before their lines? I mean, how can they? I mean, I have to, like, really focus, you know? And I thought, well, maybe, you know, you can do that. So I went back, and I was talking to people, and when I went out to do my lines, I had a few minutes to look at my, you know, to go over what I was doing. But I was, like, still thinking of what we were talking about, and I was, like, blanked. And it was really scary. And I thought, you know what? I've learned something, is that when I'm acting, I mean, I can't be farting around talking to people in the back, you know. I have to just focus on myself, basically, you know. I mean, I'm nice to people. I can talk to people, of course, you know. But for the most part, I try to keep conversations down to a minimum, to a very, very minimum. I don't try to get into any kind of, you know, big conversation, especially right before I'm going to go on. Let me tell you, that's a bad thing, bad idea. So focus on, you know, the lines, your character, That's what I have to do. And that's what I did. And I was fine. I had no problems. And likewise, I mean, let's say, you know, there are some times in the play where I have a 45-minute space between, you know, going off stage and coming back on. There are other actors there. It is respectful to, you know, not engage them in conversation. You know, if they come up and say something to you, that's one thing. But especially if you know they're going to go right on stage, you know, it's just polite not to let them, give them the respectful distance so they can prepare. Because an actor prepares. That's what our director said. And that's, you know, of course, Stanislavski, I think. But it is so true. The actor prepares. And it's always, you know, what else can you do? You know, another book I was reading about acting is that, you know, you really only have control over what you can do. You know, you have the lines, you have your marking. I mean, your what do you call it? The blocking,
right?
I'm not bored, really. You have your blocking. The director gives you the blocking. You know, there's things you cannot control. You can't control the sets. Somebody else has decided on that. The direction is, the director has decided on that. What kind of, how that he's telling, how he or she is telling the story. Blocking is set. You know, and there are, you know, some ways you can go. I mean, you have control over what? Your voice, how well you speak. Your lines, you know, how well you deliver them. You know, there are some things that you have control over, and that's what you have to focus on. So, you know, let's say you're in a scene and you don't like the way it's blocked. Well, tough titties, you know, that's not your job to do that. And it's not your responsibility. You shouldn't take, you can't, you should do it to the best of your ability, to the best, you know, to try to understand what the director's vision is. Understand your character. That's basically the best way to go get onto this, is get into the scene, is to know your character, how, what is the function of your character, and to know your lines, and also to a certain extent know your actors, the other actors' lines, because you're reacting to them. And you know, you have to react to them. And it's best not to come up with some sort of like standard reaction, you know. I mean, that can help maybe in the beginning, but you know, what I had realized is as I did the play in front of an audience, and believe me, it changes the way you're up on stage. I mean, there's a little bit of nervousness and stuff, and also as you do it, the longer you do it, the more comfortable you are with your lines, and you can move differently, you know, or react differently, because you know you're during the rehearsal you're in jeans or whatever, on stage you're in costume, and believe me, there are things you don't think of when you're in your jeans than when you're in your costume. I mean, where you put your hands in your pocket or opening your jacket, there's just different slight movements which can emphasize the lines, and I learned that as I went on. And so I think their final performance was the best, because I allowed myself to react to the other characters with my lines more easily. I was much more comfortable with it. And it's a shame, you know, it was like the, you know, four performances, and, you know, the final one's the best one, you know, for the most part. But I learned a lot, and next play I'm in, I'm going to definitely learn my lines a lot sooner. I mean, I need to spend more time learning those lines, trying to get off book really as soon as possible. I mean, after 1 or 2 weeks, if I can do that. I mean, depending on the amount of lines I have, I guess. But definitely, I would like to do it again. And I've learned to learn my lines better. I mean, learn them ahead of time. A lot sooner, you know, because we were given like a month, I think, and then we had to be off book. But I probably could have been off book if I had practiced a little bit more often in 2 weeks or whatever. So that's that. So that's that, hon. Okay. So that's The Tempest. That's The Two Gentlemen of Verona. The next Shakespeare play that the Cape Ann Shakespeare troupe is doing is The Tempest. And I told Ray is going to be directing that. He's a guy in the group. And I told him I'm interested. So I said, let me know when the tryouts are. I'll come out and try out. There are two people outside the window there. And they're talking. They look like kids. And is one a bully? No. Not here. Yeah, The Tempest. So that's exciting, you know, to do The Tempest. So I was looking through the lines. And for, you know, for the easiest, I mean, not the easiest, but an interesting role for me, I think, would be the boatswain. He's in the first scene and the last scene. So that gives me a whole, you know, 2 hours to just sit in the back and read a book. But, you know, that's the boatswain. He has, like, 12 lines or something like that, which is fine. But the 12 lines, that's just every line he speaks, okay? So the line, he also, like, you know, there's a couple good paragraphs. Actually, it's not a lot. He has, like, 1, 2, 3 paragraphs and then some, you know, lines like, work you then, that's that kind of shit. So I think it's fine, you know. I think it's probably a little too little for me, you know. I could probably memorize, you know, 3 or 4 of these two, like one, two. Let's see, there's 2 pages here in the first scene, right? 3 pages. Okay, I could probably learn triple that, and I'd be fine. Like 36 lines. So let's see, who has 36 lines in The Tempest? Let's look it up. I'm going to pause, okay? I'm back. Okay, so I took a look at Shakespeare Online. It's opensourceshakespeare.org. And you can look up the characters in the plays and how many lines they have, okay? So Thorio had 36 lines, I think. Or 39 lines, something like that. And there weren't, you know, there were some, you know, it was good. It was a good amount, I guess. So I'm thinking that, you know, between 30 and 40 lines would be good for me at this point. And there's a couple roles with 60 lines, which I think would be a challenge because it's a little bit more than I'd have to take a look at it to see what the lines are. But what I was thinking of for The Tempest, if I was going to have a bigger role, I think Ferdinand would be a good role. That's 31 lines. Alonso, he's the king of Naples. That's 40 lines. I don't know if I'm old enough to be the king of Naples. And then Trinculo, he is the jester. That's 39 lines. That would be great. And then Stefano, that's another role. That would be 60 lines. That'd be a challenging role. But I think I could do Ferdinand, Alonso, or Trinculo. Certainly the boatswain. That's only 12 lines or something like that. But and that's, you know, I'd be in and out, basically. First scene, and then, you know, that's it. Also, you know, I'd like to have a role that I don't have to wear a coat, you know, we don't have to wear a suit jacket. Tell you the truth. Because the suit I bought for the play, I got it at Kohl's for $130. And it's really, I like the fabric and everything and the way it looks. But I had pictures of me in it, and I look fat in it. I mean, the coat itself is just a little bit too big. I mean, I tried it on, and it looked good at the store. Now, I haven't been working out for a week, so maybe my muscles are a little, you know, shrunken. I don't know. But I had, what did I do? I tried on the smaller jacket, but I couldn't, like, put my arms, I couldn't. It was too tight. And so I got the next size up and it was fine. So, you know, it's awkward. I have a hard time finding clothes that fit me. It's very awkward. It's very, you know, disheartening. So maybe I'll try out for Ferdinand, Alonso, or Trinculo, or Stefano. They're the four that I think I would like to maybe try out for. And so I have the book. I have to read it. I want to read it. I really should read it for those lines, for those characters, to see, you know, where they're, what's going on with them, you know? See what you're going on with the scenes. So I can find out. So I have a So next thing is, where's my notes here? Chocolate cake. I know, this is not Retro Food Kink, though. RetroFoodKink.com. Go to RetroFoodKink.com, my cooking blog. I made chocolate cake for one of my co-actors in the play. It was his birthday Saturday. Nick. Hi, Nick, if you're listening. Lance, he's the character. And I decided I was going to make one of my old recipes, you know? And so the recipe, you know, the one that God has transcribed to my mind. And so the one I chose was one that God said is from 1907. And as I was reading the recipe, I thought to myself, Kenty, that's an awful lot of flour for the other ingredients. I mean, in proportion. Because, you know, I've made enough cakes. I sort of know the proportion of flour to sugar to eggs, whatever. But I thought to myself, maybe this is the right way. Maybe this is the way it should be made. Maybe that's, you need to have all this flour, right? So I made the cake. And my friend Coco from Paris, she came into town. And she was filming. And we learned that it was too much flour. They came out. They looked like the Ten Commandments tablets. You know, they came right out of the pan. They were stiff as a board. I threw them away. It was horrible. We tasted it, and at first it was like, oh, well, this might be okay. It's a little floury. It's a little dense. But as we let it sit and cooled, it just got worse and worse. It got gummy. It got more and more floury. The flavor went away. It was the worst effing cake I've ever made. And I mean, you know, it made a big cake. So what I did is I looked at the cake recipe again, and I figured out where the mistake was. I mean, where the typo is. I mean, the 1.5 pounds of flour is wrong. It probably should be 1.5 pounds of sugar, because apparently flour should equal or be less than the amount of sugar in your cake. I mean, yeah, the flour should equal or be less than what the amount of sugar is in the cake. And I found this on a website called Cake Baking Science. And it goes in and says, for cakes, these are the proportions. Like, let's say flour is 100. Well, then sugar should be between 100 and 145%. And egg should be this percent. And, you know, between 30 and 60, and butter should be between 30 and 60%. And it was really fascinating because, you know, it tells you how to determine whether a cake recipe will work. So now that I have this guide, I can use that to determine whether God has given me the right recipes. So that when I test them, I know I'm not just wasting flour. You know, I'm sighing, because who wants to waste flour? So when we do the test kitchen, I will have gone through the recipes, and whoever's interested in doing the test recipes for me, let me know, and I will send you, you know, some recipes. I will make sure, to the best of my knowledge, that it seems like it will work, okay? That's all I can do. And then you can, you know, of course, look at it yourself. So that's coming along. I'm working on that. Of course, this past week I haven't been working on it because I've been at the play. And the next play is in February, I think, the end of February. And we start rehearsals January 1st, so rehearsals will be soon. I would really like to know, you know, I was told, you know, we have to do, you know, rehearsals or whatever. Is that, you know, if he thinks he wants to, you know, have me in there, what roles would he want me to have? And a lot of the roles have already been cast, so you know, who knows. But like if I was to get one of these bigger roles, right, I'd want to start learning the lines. Maybe I'll just start learning the lines anyway, you know. I can be an understudy. So I want to make this devil's food cake again because it really looks good, you know. So hopefully I can do that. Hopefully I can do that. I also made another cake when my friend Coco came into town on Friday. She landed from, she came in from France. And I made a daffodil cake. I mean, isn't that great? I mean, I have this friend who is from France who came to see me in the play. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, it was just really, really terrific. So I made the daffodil cake for her, and that's an old-fashioned cake. And basically, it's a, it's like a sponge cake, like an angel food cake. And but you use the yolks as well as the whites. And you separate them, so when you put it into the pan, you have glops of yellow batter, glops of white batter, and it comes out like a daffodil. Hence, daffodil cake, because daffodils are yellow and white, so... I have to give the recipe to a friend of mine, another friend of mine who's in the area, who wants it, and so I will do that. Nice. So, on that note, on with the show. Lash! That's Brenda Starr, you hear, finishing up her scoop just for you. Brenda Starr. Hi, kids. It's another Brenda Starr update. Well, last week, Brenda Starr left Tap Fitzpatrick after having found the journal that Felicity Fox had had kept, where she reveals that it was Tap's father who killed Tap's high school sweetheart, whose name I cannot remember. And so Brenda Starr says, you know what, Tap, I have to give this information to the DA. Tap says to Brenda, you know, I'll do anything to protect father, so beware. So Brenda Starr shows up at the district attorney's office. What's her name? I forget her name already. And inside is Binky Burns. So... what's going to happen? Is Brenda Starr going to find out that Binky Burns and the DA, this woman DA, is snooping around with each other? So anyway, Brenda Starr says to is on the phone. She says, your secretary told me you were busy, Bitsy. Oh, yeah, Bitsy Hunt. You're busy, Bitsy. But this can't wait. And Bitsy says, well, Brenda, I am, I'll be right out. What? Binky Burns says. You can't let her Star see me here. And Bitsy says, better that she sees you than you sees you sneaking out. So Brenda Starr comes in with Bitsy goes out to get Brenda Starr, and she comes in, and Bitsy Hunt goes, get out of here, Mr. Burns. And Binky is like, what? And Bitsy continues by saying, I'm not answering your questions about Tap Fitzpatrick. I only talk to respectable journalists like Ms. Starr. Now get the hell out of here. You're a snoop, and I don't like you hanging around, so get the hell out. So she takes Binky Burns to the door and says, now she thinks we're enemies. Trust me. So Bitsy starts to focus on Brenda Starr, and Brenda Starr has told Bitsy that it was Tap's father who killed his girlfriend. But Bitsy Hunt is playing it cool. She's saying, yeah, really, that's a nice story you're telling me. But, you know, I don't know if that's true. I mean, it just can't possibly be true. And why are you telling me this? And Brenda Starr says, remember I said I'd tell you if I found anything significant about Tap? Well, this is pretty significant, isn't it, Bitsy Hunt? Well, to be perfectly honest, Brenda, this fiction you're giving me, I'm not sure if it's worth anything. You know, I doubt it would even hold up in court, this journal of yours. There's always journals filled with fantasies and warped memories. And are you listening, Brenda? No, Brenda's Starr is not listening, because she's looking out the window, and she's looking at Binky Burns climbing into a yellow Hummer, just like the one that she saw at the town Tapsa village or whatever he lives in. So she says, Brenda Starr thinks to herself, have I had too much coffee, or are there really yellow Hummers everywhere? And is that Binky Burns getting into that? So Bitsy keeps on going on about this case she has on Tap and saying, well, the blood on the rope that we found is Tap's, not his father's. So blah, 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 blah. Brenda Brenda Starr at this point is not listening anymore. And she says, sorry, gotta go. We'll talk later. So she gets into a cab. And she says, follow that yellow Hummer. And the taxi cab driver says, you know, it's going to cost you. And Brenda Starr says, a good story is priceless. Keep driving. And where do they end up? They end up at the ranch, my friends. The ranch. And so Brenda Starr thinks to herself, I've been duped, all right, but by whom? So, kids, by whom? Whom has duped Brenda Starr? Is it Bitsy Hunt, Binky Burns, Tap Fitzpatrick, or Tap's father? Or the ghost of Felicity Fox? Or the ghost of Trixie, the high school girlfriend? We'll possibly find out, or she could have been duped by Hank, the editor. But we'll possibly find out the answers to these questions and more next week.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and there, you're sure to fall in love with Old Cape Cod. If you like the taste of a lobster stew, served by the window with an ocean view, you're sure to fall in love with Old Cape Cod. Winding roads that seem to beckon you, miles of green beneath the skies of blue, church bells chiming on a Sunday moon remind you of the town where you were born. If you spend an evening, you'll want to stay, watching the moonlight on Cape Cod Bay. You're sure to fall in love with Old Cape Cod. Sure to fall in love with Old Cape Cod.
I just want to remind all of my listeners that I live in the state where the pilgrims came to. So that makes our state, Massachusetts, better than all of yours. I mean, I know that the English landed in Virginia. And of course, Virginia, of course, is named after the Virgin, you know, Queen Elizabeth. But Massachusetts is, you know, Massachusetts. You know, we are the ones who started everything. We are the ones with the Paul Revere and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, it's Philadelphia, but I mean, it's Philadelphia. We're Massachusetts. We have Boston. We have Harvard University. We have the very best of the very best. We're the cream of the crop. We're the start of the country. If it weren't for us, none of you people would be sitting there bitching and moaning with your tea parties. Okay? You understand? There would be no westward expansion if the pilgrims hadn't landed on the East Coast. Okay? Okay? You hear me? You understand what I'm saying? So stop your bitching and moaning about the country because we started it. And it's doing just fine. Now, you know, to continue with this, you know, to tell you about the, you know, Massachusetts and stuff. Of course, we have the first Thanksgiving here, where we so generously invited the Indians, whose land we stole, to join us and feast. Basically, to steal their ancient recipes because, you know, because the pilgrims were of English descent, and being of English descent, didn't know how to cook, especially, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and stuff and turkeys. So it was very important that we ask the Indians to teach us how to cook and survive, especially in the methods of agriculture and stuff like that, because, you know, things are different in the New World. There are things like poison ivy and horses. And, you know, we had to deal with these objects and things. So we cursed the Indians and we had a wonderful feast. Now, I just want to let you know that the very first Thanksgiving wasn't just turkey. No. We had plover, lobster, all sorts of fish and game and deer and... It was a real feast. I mean, it was, you know, part of the harvest season. So, of course, we're harvesting everything. Lots of gourds and stuff like that. I imagine that though we weren't eating tomatoes at the time, I imagine that if we had been, there would have been some canning action going on, if canning action had been existed. But I'm sure that there was some sort of salting and preserving process that the Indians... that the pilgrims did from the Indians. And I think it's just wonderful. How thankful can you be, you know, if you survived the first year having landed in this desert land in, what was it, the tip of Cape Cod? It was Provincetown, I think it was. I mean, imagine that the pilgrims lasted that long after, you know, because even back then, Provincetown, the area was known for its, you know, gay sex. All the gay Indians lived there. I mean, it's imagine that the pilgrims survived the ass raping and all that gay agenda, you know, brought it in here. But that was the seeds of the gay agenda, my friends, is that the pilgrims, unsuspecting, landed on Cape Cod in Provincetown and were ass raped by the gay Indians and taught the gay agenda. Of course, the pilgrims did not speak the language of the Indians, and so they didn't really understand what is happening, but it's part of our genetic culture. And I think it's, you know, you can read about it in the history, you know, the different writings, though they, for some reason, they leave out that very important part of history where the Indians, the gay Indians, ass rape the pilgrims in Provincetown and teach them how to go to tea dances and, you know, all sorts of things, which is part of the gay agenda. So I'm celebrating our history, you know, in Massachusetts and, of course, you know, the gay history because it is where it all started. I mean, gay marriage is here. Is there any wonder? And just like liberty in America, you know, spread from Massachusetts, gay marriage is going to spread too. Everything happens here first. And we'll spread across the country to the farthest mountains and regions and valleys and deserts across America and even into Mexico and Canada, even though Canada has gay marriage. It really doesn't count until the United States has gay marriage. And I'm just thankful for that. You know, I'm thankful for living in a state where we originate all the great ideas, which lead this country to a future full of abundance and niceties and liberty, because we don't have Tea Party people up here. I mean, they call themselves Tea Party people, but they really aren't. Not like the Yahoos in the other parts of the country. Not that all Tea Party people are Yahoos, but, you know, those that are Yahoos I'm talking about. And, you know, just remember to visit Old Cape Cod.
Everybody has a sweetheart underneath the rose. Everybody loves a buddy, so the old song goes. I've a sweetheart, you all know him just as well as me. Every evening I can see him shortly after tea. My sweetheart's the man in the moon. I'm going to marry him soon. 'Twould fill me with bliss just to give him one kiss, but I know that a dozen I never would miss. I'll go up in a great big balloon and see my sweetheart in the moon. Then behind some dark cloud where no one is allowed, I'll make love to the man in the moon. I have often wondered where he spends his time all day. Perhaps he has another sweetheart many miles away. Maybe some sweet dark-haired maiden daily he does woo. But as long as I don't catch him, I'll believe him true. Last night while the stars brightly shone, he told me through love's telephone that when we were wed, he'd go early to bed and never stay out with the boys. So he said, we are going to marry next June. The wedding takes place in the moon. A sweet little Venus will fondle between us. When I wed my old man in the moon.
The Ocean of Song by Ella Wheeler Wilcox. In a land beyond sight or conceiving, in a land where no blight is, no wrong, no darkness, no graves, and no grieving, there lies the great ocean of song. And its waves, oh, its waves unbeholden by any save gods and their kind, are not blue, are not green, but are golden, like moonlight and sunlight combined. It was whispered to me that their waters were made from the gathered-up tears that were wept by the sons and the daughters of long-vanished errors and spheres. Like white sands of heaven the spray is that falls all the happy day long, and whoever it touches straightway is made glad with the spirit of song. Up, up to the clouds where their hoary crowned heads melt away in the skies. The beautiful mountains of glory each side of the song ocean rise. Here day is one splendor of skylight, of God's light with beauty replete. Here night is not night, but is twilight, pervading, enfolding, and sweet. Bright birds from all climes and all regions that sing the whole glad summer long are dumb till they flock here in legions and lave in the ocean of song. It is here that the four winds of heaven, the winds that do sing and rejoice, it is here they first came and were given the secret of sound and of voice. Far down along beautiful beaches, by night and by glorious day, the throng and the gifted one reaches their foreheads made white with the spray. And a few of the sons and the daughters of this kingdom, cloud-hidden from sight, go down in the wonderful waters and bathe in those billows of light. And their souls evermore are like fountains, and liquid and lucent and strong. High over the tops of the mountains gush up the sweet billows of song. No drought time of waters can dry them. Whoever has bathed in that sea, all dangers, all deaths, they defy them, and are gladder than gods are with glee.
You've been listening to The Flatus Show. You can reach me at flatusshow@gmail.com or come by and visit my website at theflatusshow.com. Thank you for listening.
From this mighty heavyweight. His first round bout doesn't trouble him greatly. Within minutes, the champ flips his opponent onto his back. In normal Olympic wrestling, grips and holds score points. But here, with lubrication in abundance, it's impossible to get a hold onto the body. It's all about brute force and balance. A win comes by lifting the opponent up and taking three paces, or forcing him onto his back. There are very few places to get a proper grip, and hands-down pants is a common sight in the Yarlagaresh arena. It's the only place to get decent leverage. I find it hard to imagine an English man clad only in black leather covering his body in olive oil and sticking his hands down his opponent's pants. He'd be embarrassed, insecure, afraid of what people would think. Turkish men do it with nobility and conviction. They're proud of their masculinity.
Maybe we should get to know each other better.